Good morning, everyone. Hope you're having a good Sunday and a good weekend. We're in the middle of the series, as you see, called Reroute. And the idea is that all of us have things that we're aiming to do. All of us have plans. Maybe you have desires for your family, for your children. Maybe you have dreams for the future. We're here now in a certain place because of a plan or an idea you had in the past. But sometimes we've made decisions along the way, and we ended up in places that maybe we didn't expect. Maybe it was a good decision, but you ended up in a place where you didn't expect and you needed to make a change. Maybe it was a foolish decision and you needed to kind of pick up the pieces and start again. We've all had these moments where, in essence, we needed to kind of restart or to reroute. And so we're using the life of David. We're looking at some key elements in the life of David, where moments where he had to reroute. And I'm excited, looking forward to the rest of this series as we go forward the next couple weeks. This morning, we're going to look at David's struggle of how he struggled to relate to God, of how he struggled to show up with God, of how he struggled to move toward God, whatever language you want to use. And that was his struggle. I still think it could be a struggle for us here today. Maybe part of your story, maybe part of your experience is that you struggle to relate to God. Maybe there's disappointment when you think about you and relating to God and how God relates to you. Maybe there's fear. Maybe there's anger. Maybe there's shame. Maybe whatever it is, but we have these seasons in life, all of us do, no matter your faith perspective, where we struggle to understand how do we relate to God and how is God relating to us. I'm excited to take you through the story of David this morning because we're going to follow the journey of the Ark of the Covenant, this place where God said he would meet with his people, this very presence of God among his people. And I want to take you through that journey because in the midst of that journey is a journey of a people struggling to learn to relate to God. What I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about that journey and that history. I want to show you David's struggle with the ark, how David rerouted, the change that David made, and then a couple suggestions that maybe could help you as you think through this in your own life and your own family. Before we do that, I want to ask you to join with me in a word of prayer. Let's pray. God, I pray that as we just sang that we would be open to be present with you. We believe that there's grace here and now, and that you have moved toward us. And so often, God, we put things in front of this relationship, of this relating back and forth. And sometimes life gets sideways, and we lose grip, or we lose a step. And I pray, God, that even as we are attentive and open to what you have to say to us today, as individuals, as families, as a community of faith, that we would continually press toward you, knowing that you are inviting us to move toward you. Thank you that for your word and for stories of people who have sought to move toward you. And may we learn, may we be attentive, and may you continue to grow us in new and fresh ways today. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to be in 2 Samuel chapter 6, but I more want to tell you the story than read it today. We're going to be a little bit in 1 Samuel. You can go read that later on your own, but we're going to be in 2 Samuel is where we're going to land today. But I want to tell you the story of this and tell you the story of this people struggling to relate and try to understand how they struggled to relate to God. And my hope out of this is that you would find encouragement, that you would find encouragement as David found a way to reroute, that you would find encouragement of what it means to be present with the presence of God in your own life, that you would day in and day out be willing to move toward God as God is moving toward you. To give you a little context of where we were, last week Mark talked about the beginning of 2 Samuel, and he talked about lament and these different seasons of life, and he talked about how David was lamenting the death of Saul and Jonathan. To kind of connect where we there in 2 Samuel chapter 6, where we'll land today, is that after David laments, there are enemies, domestic and foreign, that get dealt with. And then David gets to Jerusalem, and he's establishing his kingdom. He's establishing this kingship that God had promised him about a decade earlier. And at the heart of this, and at the heart of David establishing this kingship, is this object, this holy relic of sorts, or at least what they saw at the time, was this holy object, the Ark of the Covenant. Now, maybe you remember the Ark of the Covenant from movie fame, Indiana Jones and such, but the Ark in the Old Testament was the place where God promised to meet with his people at that particular time in history. It held the Ten Commandments, it held Aaron's staff, it held some of the manna that God had given to his people in the desert. This was the place of presence. This was the place of glory among his people. This was the place where God said, this is the place I'm going to relate to you and you're going to relate to me. But almost throughout its history, the Ark's history, was this struggle of people learning what that meant, that it wasn't simply an object, it wasn't simply a relic, but it was an invitation to relationship. At the beginning of 1 Samuel, and you can read it later on your own, we see some of this struggle. There's one of the first spiritual leaders of the nation at that time, Eli. He has two sons who are priests of that time, and they're kind of caretakers of the ark. And Israel at that time, at the beginning of 1 Samuel, they're in battle with the Philistines. And they go into this battle with the Philistines, and they lose. And the leaders of the battle say, oh, I know why we lost today. We didn't have the ark, and we didn't have the priest with us. And so they call Eli's sons, the priests, and they say, why don't you come with us, and why don't you bring the ark, because that'll be what we need. And you kind of go, hold on, it seems like this isn't really the intent of the ark. It's not like a good luck charm that you bring with you into battle. But that's how they saw it. And so they bring Eli's sons, the priest, and they bring the ark into battle. And the next day, Israel's defeated even worse. And not only that, but Eli's sons are killed. And not only that, that the ark is taken by the Philistines. And you realize, I don't think they've really understood what it means to relate to God. A messenger escapes from that battle, goes back and tells Eli, Eli, Israel has been defeated in battle. And Eli, not only that, your sons have been killed. And not only that, Eli, the ark, the glory of God, the presence of God among his people has been taken by the Philistines. And when Eli hears that, it says in 1 Samuel, I think chapter 4, when Eli hears that, he falls over and he dies. Nearby, his daughter-in-law, whose husband was just killed in battle, he also hears the same news, that not only is her husband has died, but the ark, the presence, the glory of God has been taken. And she gives birth in that moment. She was pregnant, and she gives birth in the midst of her distress, and she has a baby boy, and she names the baby boy Ichabod, which means the glory of God is gone. At the very beginning of this story and this people's history with this ark of the presence of God is people who've seen, we just see it as this lucky charm that'll win us a few battles, and you get a few people who realize, no, it's much more than this, and now it's gone. The presence of God is gone. The Philistines take the ark. The Philistines take the ark, and they take it to one of their towns called Ashdod. And they stick it in one of their temples, of one of their gods. His name is Dagon. And there's this big statue of Dagon. And they stick it next to him, and they kind of close up shop for the night. The priests of that temple close up shop. And the next morning, they come in, and there's an interesting thing that's happened, is that their statue of their god Dagon has fallen face down before the ark of the Lord. And they say, well, you know what? Maybe there was like a little bit of an earthquake. Maybe someone came in and is messing with us. So we'll just prop this Dagon back up. And so they prop Dagon back up, lock up for the night. The next morning, not only is Dagon face down again before the Ark of the Covenant, but this time his hands are cut off and his head is cut off. And they quickly get the clue that this isn't simply some object that we've captured. There's something more going on. And so they take that ark, and they want it out of there, and so they send it off to one of their other towns called Gath, and it gets to Gath, and there's all this distress and disaster happening at Gath, and they say, we don't want this anymore, and so let's send it on to Ekron. And Ekron's heard the news by now, and they're like, don't even bring that here. And so they see it, they're like, no, it's not even getting in our city gates here. And the Philistine leaders who have captured this ark realize that there's something about this God of Israel that's different than any other god that they have. And they don't know what to do with him. And so their solution is, let's just give it back. This was a mistake to take it. And so they load up the ark. They get a new cart, and they get new oxen to pull the cart. And they load up the ark, and they throw in some gifts as well. Just kind of like, we're sorry about stealing your ark. And they load it up on a cart and cattle, and they send it off to the Israelite town Beth Shemesh. And when the people of that town see the ark coming up the road, they start to rejoice and they're celebrating. They're like, finally, the presence of God, the glory of God is back with us. But you also realize quickly that they don't really get it. Because when it gets back into town, everyone's like, this is great. But then there are a few people who are like, yeah, but I bet the Philistines took all the good stuff out of it. Yeah, it's really nice on the outside. It looks like how we left it. But, you know, there's some stuff in the inside that we really, really need. And so even though God said don't touch the ark, and even though God said don't look in the ark, a few of them do. And in 1 Samuel chapter 6, it says that day that 70 people died because they looked in the ark. And the people of that town say this statement. They say, who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God. They don't know what it means to relate to God. They don't know how to be present in the presence of God. God has become an object for them to move around, to put in order, to control, to conquer. And no one stopped to realize, hold on, maybe this is something more. Maybe the presence of God is for something for us to show up and engage and relate with. People of Beth Shemesh, as you can imagine, are quite freaked out. So they find a guy, they nominate a guy named Abinadab, and they say, congratulations, you are now the winner of an Ark of the Covenant, and we're going to just park it at your house. And for 20 years, it stays at Abinadab's house. Until 2 Samuel chapter 6, where we are today, where David, as he's establishing his kingdom, says, I want the Ark. 2 Samuel chapter 6, David, building his kingdom, he says he wants the ark, and what he does is he travels down to Abinadab's house, and we're told in the first verse that he takes 30,000 young men with him. He takes a cart with him. He takes cattle with him to bring back the ark, and they go down to Abinadab's house, and they say, we're here for the ark, thank you very much, and they load it up on the cart. They attach the oxen to it, and they start to go down the road with it, and as they're going down the road, something happens is that like one of the oxen kind of like loses its footing, which then tips the cart, which then tips the ark. And one of Abinadab's sons, who had been around the ark for the past 20 years, is journeying with them, kind of helping them get it back to Jerusalem. And his name's Uzzah. And Uzzah's walking along beside the ark. And as the ark starts to tumble, he kind of does what you and I would do. He just kind of reaches out. We don't want this thing to fall on the ground. We don't want it to break open. And so he reaches out to steady the ark. And when he does, he drops dead. God said, don't touch the ark. God said, don't look in the ark. And you might go, well, that's pretty extreme. He didn't have any malintent. He's just trying to hold it up there. And if you think that's extreme, that's how David felt too, because we're told in verse 8 that David was angry because of the Lord's wrath. 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 8. And not only that, in verse 9, it says that David was also afraid of the Lord that day. And there's a statement that David makes that kind of reminds us of the people of Beth Shemesh. He says, how can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? Maybe you felt that. Maybe you have felt that moment of like, how can I ever get right with God? How can I ever understand this relationship? It feels so distant. I feel afraid or angry. I feel disappointed. I feel filled with shame, whatever the language is for you. How could this ever come to me? I think part of David's problem, in order to see his reroute, I think you need to see part of his problem. And I think part of David's problem is that David had lost the ability to understand what it meant to relate to God. David had seen God just like everyone else had, as an object. He'd seen the ark as an object for him. It was an object for him to use to legitimize his kingdom. Hey, I've got everything built, everything prepared in Jerusalem, and I just need the ark, and that'll be kind of the finishing touch on this whole thing. He also saw the ark as an object for him to conquer. I mean, he takes 30,000 young men, it says in verse 1. You know what that is? That's an army, literally. The young men would be the army, 30,000 guys to go get the ark. For David, this is an object for him, rather than an invitation to relate. Something along the way got lost for David. 20th century philosopher, Austrian philosopher Martin Buber wrote this well-known book called I and Thou. And he says this interesting thing in it. He says, as human beings, we see the world through one of two ways. You see your family, you see your kids, you see your spouse, you see nature, you see God, you see the people you work with, whatever it is. He says, you either see it through one of two ways. Either I see you through an I-Thou relationship. In other words, I see you as a person with feelings and emotions and thoughts as created by God, or I see you as an object, as an I-it relationship. Maybe I see you as an object I need to get past. Maybe I see you as someone I need to brush by. Maybe I need to see you as someone I need to use for my own agenda and purposes. And if you're not familiar with that language, you have probably felt that. You can probably think back to stories in your life where you have felt as an it in someone else's world. That someone's just trying to get past you, or someone's trying to use your advancements to better their own career. Someone's just trying to listen to you just to be polite. They're not really trying to understand. We can all think through moments like this. Maybe tragic moments like that where you have felt as an object in someone else's world. And we've done that to people. I mean, if we're honest, I've done that to people. You've done that to people. Probably in this week, there have been moments where it's like, not that person again. Not that person while I'm trying to get everything done, or whatever the case may be. We can default and live, and so easily to see the world and to see others in self-justifying ways rather than risk showing up and being present. I mean, you can think through what this looks like in a beautiful way because you can imagine, hopefully you have memories and hopefully recent memories where someone has done the opposite, where someone has treated you in that I-thou relationship, when they've sat across from you and asked you questions and been present with you and listened. And you've known in that moment, this is a different kind of conversation than any other conversation I have. Somewhere along the way, the ark, the presence of God, the place of glory of God for Eli's sons, for the Philistines, for the people of Beth Shemesh, and now for David, it had become this object. They had lived with it of like, we're going to take it here, we're going to put it in this temple, we're going to use it to make our battle go well, and somewhere along the line, they'd stopped realizing, no, this is the invitation of God to meet with you. This is an invitation to be present with the presence of God. This is an invitation to show up and move toward God. God was not someone for them to use, to order, to conquer. Not someone to put out, take out, and put on display over and over again. Who would be the person willing enough to risk what it would take to be present with God? Who would be the person somewhere in this story, in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, who's going to be the person willing to think things differently, willing to see this situation from a different perspective? That's where David's reroute comes in. That's where I think he'll have some things for us as well in our own stories. But David's reroute happens like this. After the whole thing with Uzzah, they dump the ark at another guy's house. His name's Obed-Edom. And they just say, you know what, you're going to keep this. We don't know what to do with it. And so for 3 months, it sits with this guy, Obed-Edom. And then one day, David gets news. Someone comes and tells him, he's like, you remember Obed-Edom? Yeah. Well, his household is blessed beyond measure because the ark is there. And David says something interesting. He says, all right, let's go get it. He's willing to give it another try. He's willing to take a risk. He's willing to start again. Maybe he missed something. Maybe there's something he needs to rethink. And so he goes down to Obed-Edom's house, but this time it's different. This time there's no cart. This time instead, when they show up at Obed-Edom's house, they start to carry the ark because the ark was meant not to be put on a cart, but to be carried on poles. In fact, when they get to Obed-Edom's house, there's no cart. There's David getting a couple guys and say, okay, you, you're going to now carry this ark. In fact, the ark was built in such a way that there are poles sticking outside of the ark. It's like somewhere along the lines, no one ever asked questions. Why are the poles there? What are we going to do with these poles? Everyone had just put it on a cart because that's what the people before them had done, and that's what the people before them had done. And no one stopped to question and wonder, is this really how we're going to relate to God, that we just put our agenda on this thing? No, no, no. It seems like David stopped and said, hold on, if this is God relating to us, maybe we need to turn around and say, okay, God, how did you design this thing to work? And so they get poles, they carry it. Excuse me, it says in verse 13. They get to Obed-Edom's house and they carry the poles. And you got to imagine, I imagine what it was like when David like chose the guys to carry that. Because he was like, okay, I need you and you and you. Come on over here. You're going to lift this thing up. And they, I'm not touching that. I was there when Uzzah was there. I'm not getting anywhere near it. And it's like, no, you're get over here. You're coming. And so he gets the guys. And you can imagine this moment here that he gets the guys. And they lift up the pole and or the ark on the poles. And they kind of hoist it on their shoulders. And I just kind of imagine the first step. They're just kind of like shaking a little bit. Not because it's heavy. Because they're just not sure what's going to happen. And like they take the first step. Okay, no earthquake, no whatever. And then they take the second step and they're looking around to make sure everyone else is like still alive and it's okay. And then they take a third step and they take a fourth step and they take a fifth step. And then the text says they take a sixth step. And when they take six steps, they take the ark, they stop, and they put it on the ground. And they have a worship service to God. When they took six steps, they realized this is a different way. They've realized what it means to relate to God. They realize this isn't an object. He is not an object for us to use and to put out and to order and control. This is one who has something for us. At six steps, they realize something has dramatically changed. They take six steps, and they begin to see God in a whole new way. And all it took, not all it took, but it took David, his reroute, was willing to take another step toward God, to be vulnerable, to risk again, and to realize this wasn't about carts, it was about poles. This is the way God designed things to be. And once David got himself off his hands, so to speak, he started to see how God designed things to be. And as he did that, he realized, oh, this is a much more dynamic relationship than I ever imagined. And we just need to stop before we get back to Jerusalem because I just need to commemorate this moment right now. And if you think nothing changed, watch what happens next. In the next set of verses there, in verses 14 and 15, David changes his clothes, which seems like a bit of an odd time to go through a wardrobe change, but he's changing his clothes. It's a pretty powerful moment of an external change of something that you think is probably happening internally as well. He takes off his kingship. He takes off all that stuff of what it means to have power and to control and to subdue other people and other things. And it says he puts on the garment of a priest. The priest was the one who communed with God, who was in community with God, who related to God. It's this powerful image where David's like, I'm done trying to control and put things in order and put even this God thing in order, and I'm now ready to show up. I'm now ready to be present. I'm now ready to take things on God's way. That there's something here that I've never considered before. David's problem that somewhere along the lines, he lost the ability to relate to God. And then he got poles. And then he realized, oh, this God, this relationship is a far more dynamic than I ever imagined. And you see him celebrating. The chapter goes on. You can read it later as well on your own. David's celebration of this new type and this new experience of relating to God. Of him being fully present with the presence of God. It ends with David full of joy in this new type of community. He's somewhere along the lines lost the ability to relate to God, and his reroute is, I got poles, and part of me getting poles is I'm going to start showing up, and I'm going to start being present. I'm going to move toward you on your terms, God, knowing and believing that you're moving toward So there's a lot in this story. As I think through this and I think about you and me and our various journeys and our relationship with God, no matter what you may think about God, I trust you're here because there's something about this that that God is speaking to you in your own way, in your own life. And I thought through a couple ways that what it would look like for me to get pulls or for you to get pulls. What it would look like for us to do that reroute, to show up in new ways that God, this thing isn't about subduing you. It's not about controlling you. It's not about getting you in order. It's about me fully showing up and being present with you and doing things on your terms and realizing actually you're moving towards me in ways that I've never considered before. And so I thought through four things that maybe could help you. Maybe one of these could help, maybe two of these, maybe all four could help, and there's probably more. But as I read through David's reroute, here are a couple things that stand out to me. Here are four things. First one is this. Maybe for you and me, maybe us getting pulls is asking new questions. I think about what that moment would have been like for David to go, oh, Obed-Edom's getting blessed. Obed-Edom, his household is getting blessed. I'm angry and full of fear with God, and this other guy is getting blessed. Maybe there's something I'm missing. Maybe there's something I'm not seeing. And if I think through the seasons of my life where I felt distant with God or disappointed or angry or whatever the thing may be, sometimes for me, that reroute, that getting of pulls is just asking new questions. Of having a new conversation. Maybe it means even having that conversation with God. One of the things that has encouraged me the last few months is I've been thinking about my relationship with God as a conversation where we're both speaking. Doesn't mean I'm equal with God. I'm not saying that. I just like, it's not a monologue this way and it's not a monologue that way. It's like, here, God, I mean, if we're relating, here's kind of, there's me today. And I want to hear from you. Let's have this conversation. What are the ways that you're speaking and working in my life that maybe I'm not paying attention to? Maybe it's asking new questions. Maybe you moving toward God today. Maybe you learning this new dance of relationship with God is asking new questions. Maybe for you, the second thing is maybe seeing this presence in other people. Maybe for you, distance with God. Or times where you just feel disconnected with God, maybe you just need to get around other people who seem like they've got pulls in their life, that they seem to have figured it out somehow in some way. And I love how Laura put it, like, we're not perfect. No one here is perfect. And we need people. We need each other to help each other along. I hope you have conversations here each week. I love that we've got the food and different stuff under the marquee from time to time because it gives you space just to have a 5-minute conversation or 10-minute conversation or something with somebody who may be experiencing and be present in the presence of God even when you're not. And you go, I don't feel this right now. I know there's truth somehow sitting over me, but I'm just not there right now. And maybe a conversation will encourage you to go, I see God in a new way. They're working in their life. Maybe he's still at work in mine. That there's a powerful moment when David heard about Obed-Edom. I think there's something in him that realized, oh, this is a God of grace. I'm missing out on this, and I want to know this, and he's willing to take a chance. Third, maybe for you, moving toward God means acting as if there is grace, because there is grace. David was willing to take a risk. He was willing to go back and get the ark. He didn't stay in his anger and his fear. He didn't say, you know what? I've tried that. I've gone down that route, and I'm done with that. Do you ever said that? I've been there. I'm like, you know what? I've tried this and this and this. I'm done. I'm finished. Not with David. Like, he was like, you know what? Let's try it again. But I wonder if, and it's me obviously implying into this, but I wonder if there was a sense of he realized, maybe there's grace waiting for me on the other side of this. Maybe if I'm willing to show up, maybe if I'm willing to move toward God, maybe there's grace there. And here's the thing I would say to you this morning here in the Fox Theater. There is grace. There is grace for you. When you think you've gotten to the end of grace, there's still more grace. And when you've gotten to the end of that grace, there's not any more grace. No, I'm kidding. There's more grace after that. Just making sure you're still awake with me here. There's no end to grace, as we aptly sang about earlier this morning. There is no end to grace. And so when you think you've used all of God's grace for you up, and you think, well, he's got to save some grace for other people. No. There's still grace for you. When you wake up tomorrow, there'll be more grace for you. Later today, there's more grace for you. A year from now, 30 years from now, there is more grace. And sometimes we get stuck in ways that we say, you know what? Well, man, I've really tried God's patience here. And so that's it. I'm done. He's probably done with me. But what if you acted as if there's more grace? Like, what are you not doing now? What are you not praying now? What are you not hoping for now because you fear that there's not grace for it? Maybe you moving toward God and being showing up with God and being present and engaging in relationship with God is you taking a step of faith. And faith is believing there's more grace. There's more grace. Lastly is this. For you, moving toward God and moving toward relationship with God is that you begin to rethink how God sees you. You begin to rethink how God sees you. I think of that moment when they had the ark and that moment where they take the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 steps. And at that 6th step, I can imagine, I wonder what that moment was like for them. Like, internally, what was going on for them? I think part of it, at least, is they realize, hold on, maybe God sees us in a way that we've never considered. Yes, we're trying to see God in a new way, but maybe as we're doing that, maybe he sees us in a way that we haven't considered before. I don't know about you, but I can get in seasons where I've just kind of relegated myself and how God sees me into this little bucket over here, not realizing it's a lot broader than I ever imagined. Paul, the Apostle Paul, writing to the church in Ephesus, went through this whole first chapter in Ephesians 1. You should go read it later. Talking about anyone who says yes to Jesus, who they are, who God has said that they are. And he says this interesting thing. He's in the midst of a lot of other words. He says that God is a God who gives grace to you. And he gives grace freely, and he gives grace lavishly. I mean, have you ever thought about that? That in Jesus, God has given you grace freely. In other words, no one's twisting his arm. No one's saying, God, it's Tuesday. You better give grace to that guy. It's his free willingness to give to you. And not only does he give freely and he's like, well, all right, I'll just give a dollar since I've got to give. No. He gives lavishly. That God sees you in such a way through Jesus that he gives freely and he gives lavishly. There is not an end to that type of grace. That is the type of grace that keeps chasing after you and chasing after you every day. And I wonder how much of our problems, how much of our struggles, how much of our anxieties, how much of our worries, how much of our frustrations and my frustrations would just be settled if we just like memorized that. What if we just spoke that? What if we wrote that somewhere tomorrow morning and just looked at that before we got going on the day? Hold on a second. How God sees me, he sees me as one who gives grace to freely and lavishly. That's how God sees you. This is what I try to say each time I'm up here, is that this is what he's done for you in Jesus. Jesus died for you for the ultimate reroutes to bring you to a new place and new life with God. And anyone who says yes to him has that new life. And it's a new life marked by grace that is given freely and lavishly. Paul goes on to say this too, and we could keep going on Ephesians 1, but he says this last little thing as a close here. He says this, that this grace that God gives, he does it in such a way that he now adopts you as his son or daughter. He adopts you into his family. Maybe today you've come in here and you have felt like you've been trying to get God's attention, you've been trying to move towards God, and he feels like he just keeps running away from you, or you feel like it just keeps getting more and more distant, more and more absent, and you realize, what does it take for me to get in? And it's like, you say yes to Jesus, you're in. Like, you're already in. You're part of the family. Maybe for you today, moving toward God is starting to see how God sees. There's a lot more to this David story, and I invite you to look at the first couple chapters of 1 Samuel, and as far as in this chapter as well, 2 Samuel. You can do that with your family. You can do that with your small group. And really consider as you do that, as you have these conversations with people that you're around, is what's standing in front of you? What's stopping you from showing up with God? What's stopping you from moving toward God? Because here's the thing you're going to find, is that in all of your efforts, and all of your struggles, and all of my struggles to move toward God, you're going to find that God has been moving toward you the entire time. And the invitation is there for you today. The invitation is to come with everything that you are. And as Savannah said earlier, you change that and receive who God is and what he has said over you. I want to pray for you and pray for you as you consider this journey in your own life. Would you join with me in prayer? God, thank you that you speak something new over us. Thank you that you give us opportunities to ask new questions, to opportunities to see your presence and your life at work in other people. Opportunities to act in faith and trust that there's grace on the other side. And would you open our eyes, God, to see how you see us? Would we be people who get pulls, who in the midst of our struggle and our distance, in the midst of trying to understand what it means to relate to you, that we'd start to see things from your perspective? Would we be people who are willing to take the risk and be vulnerable with you? And now all of our struggles to be vulnerable with other people or to relate to other people, that we would start with you. And thank you that there's grace. There's grace that is freely given to us and is lavishly poured out on us. It's your grace. Would we be people who are marked by that, who live like that, who parent like that, who are married like that, who work like that, who manage like that? Would we be people who carry grace wherever we go? Thank you that you're moving toward us in all of our journey and struggle to move toward you. Would we know and feel and see that you are moving toward us? In Jesus' name.